For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and coming up this week, blind chef Kim Jay tells us how lockdown inspired her to write two accessible cookbooks and shares her passion for reading. Narrator David John discusses the joys and challenges of recording talking books. And we begin our review of the shortlisters for this year's Silip Carnegie Medal by interviewing former winner and 2021 contender Elizabeth Acevedo. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Many listeners will already know about Kim Jay. An avid cook and former restaurateur, she's based in the northwest of England, where she's one of RNIB's most active volunteers. No stranger to adversity, she hasn't let sight loss or, more recently, COVID, stop her. And she's recently published two cookbooks, the proceeds of which go to RNIB. But I'd heard rumours that her interest in writing spread further than that, so decided to get her in for questioning. Kim, welcome to Connect Radio.
Thank you for having me on. I'm looking forward to this.
So to give people a bit of background, you have always been a keen chef and I believe you owned your own restaurant.
I did at one time. It was a restaurant that served fusion food, which is dishes from all over the world, combining the different cultures and the tastes and the spices and flavours. Now, a lot of our dishes on the menu were actual recipes from the 50s and 60s, wartime recipes, which I kind of reinvented, modernized it and served, and it was brilliant.
And then, of course, unfortunately, sight loss got in the way. But just before the pandemic broke out, you were organizing face-to-face cooking lessons for blind and partially sighted people.
I was. I'm Indian, and everybody wants to learn how to make Indian food. So when RNIV discovered that I was a chef, they asked if we could organise face-to-face cooking lessons on Indian cuisine. So we had the first one, and then, unfortunately, as we were organising the second one, the pandemic hit, and we had to stop. And like everybody else in those first few days and weeks, I was really bored, sitting at home, not doing anything much. And I thought, oh, I wonder what I can do to keep myself busy. So I went into the kitchen, and with the help of a support worker, we made an Indian dish, chana masala, which we recorded and put on Facebook. And the next thing I knew, the response was phenomenal. Everybody was thrilled that somebody was helping to show them how to be able to get back into the kitchen using accessible equipment, using the other sensors, and giving hints and tips for visually impaired. And before I knew it, I was making recipes and videos almost every week. The response was amazing. It went international. And I wrote a cookery book called A Taste of Spice to go alongside the Indian cuisine, and that went really well. And it was written predominantly for the visually impaired. So it's in large print to make it much easier, especially for magnification. And all the profits of the book is going to RNIV to help facilitate more cookery lessons and to raise money for audio books. And as time went, I started doing some of the recipes that I used to make in the restaurant. Things like roasted pork and Wellington and vegan dishes. So to go alongside the mainstream recipes, I wrote another cookery book called A Sense of Cooking. Again, it's in large print and it's got helpful hints and tips for visually impaired people.
You see, I think this is genius because one of the great frustrations of my life is that I've got all these beautifully illustrated cookbooks with pictures that mean nothing, and then tiny, tiny, tiny print underneath that I can't read, and that actually even my wife, without her reading glasses, struggles to see. So actually concentrating on the information is just brilliant. And you've really found a market for these.
Yes, I have, both with the visually impaired community and the mainstream community. It's exactly like you said, you read a recipe and it's small print. And as you're cooking and you keep glancing at the recipe book, it is really difficult. So having it in large print is really good. And I've made the directions very concise, very simplified, so it's easy to follow. And I made a point of not putting photographs into the book, mainly because being visually impaired, it's useless. If you do have some sight, all you see is a blur of colour or little bits of the photograph, so it's useless. What you really need are those hints and tips that take you through those different steps to actually produce some amazing food.
Exactly. It's about the taste rather than the look, isn't it?
It is. And I think this is one of the things where being visually impaired actually does help when you cook. Because when you're sighted, most people that are sighted only use two of their senses, sight and taste. Now, when you're visually impaired, you do use the very little sight that you have, but you also use your hearing, hearing spices crackle, hearing the way that sauces are bubbling. You get a picture already forming. Then you've got your sense of smell. When you can tell, for instance, when I put a cake in the oven, I can tell by the smell that it's almost ready to be taken out because the smell gets stronger and stronger. Then you've got your sense of touch. For instance, you take a steak. Everybody wants to know, how do I cook a perfect steak when I'm visually impaired? And the answer is simple. You take your hand, not your predominant hand, the opposite hand, and if you feel under your thumb that fleshy bit, that's when a steak is raw, that's the texture. You go to the finger next to it, you've now got a rare steak. Go to the finger next to that, your middle finger, and you've got a steak that's medium. Go further along and you've got a steak that's well done. So texture, taste, smell, hearing, they're brilliant when you're cooking. What you really need the most is confidence. Confidence to know that you can do it, to get into that kitchen and to start cooking. And it's so, so therapeutic, especially when you're stuck indoors for a great length of time. One of the things with being visually impaired, and I really struggle with it, is the isolation. You can be in a room full of people and you're still isolated because you can't see what's going on. You can't access information as fast as anyone else. Getting into the kitchen and having control of these random ingredients to be able to put them together and produce something that is amazing is so therapeutic.
And of course, you can also be listening to an R&IB talking book. And I believe that talking books are one of the things that have helped you deal with your own sight loss.
Yes. I think without the talking books of the RNIV service, I have no idea how I could have managed on my sight loss journey. It took me a long time to be able to actually put on an audio book because when I lost my sight, I used to read a lot. I loved reading. I was a writer. I'd written a couple of novels. I was writing articles for radio stations and had a column in the local newspaper. So writing and reading was really important. And when I lost my sight, the thing that I missed the most was to be able to pick up a book and read. So it took me a long time before I actually got an audio book and put it in. And once I did, I never looked back. Over 200 books a year I listened to. And the thing with listening to the audio books, it takes you out of the world that you're living in. It takes you out of your reality. And it lets your imagination go free and it just roams everywhere. So I can go to places that I've never been before. I can experience, for instance, climbing a mountain or the environment in Spain or a desert or on the moon. I can live the lives with other people. And that is so important to me.
And both your love of books and your recent publishing success with the two cookbooks has inspired you to start writing again.
It has. I started writing a fantasy novel. I'm halfway through it at the moment, and it has been an amazing journey. I don't think I would have had the confidence to be able to do this again had it not been for the services of the audio library with RNIB and the support from RNIB that I've got. I've managed to get a laptop with all the technology that I need to be able to write. So I use the software Fusion, which is a combination of Zoom and JAWS, and together with Dragon, which is a dictation software, I've started to write, and I am loving every second of it. And the one thing that I really do want to get across is we all have dreams. And when you lose your sight, you also lose sight of the dreams that you have. And the one thing I want to say to everyone is don't lose sight of that. There are ways of trying to fulfill your dreams. In my case, to be able to get the software, to get the technology and the support to be able to do what I love doing the most. There are always ways of getting around things. You just need to be able to ask for help and support and find the way, and don't give up on those dreams.
And that's such an important message for all of us to remember, and why it's so vital that we have people like you volunteering for RNIB to help those who are new to sight loss understand their experience and realise that there is a path through.
I always say I learn as much as I teach. All of us have hints, tips, advice. And if we all share those hints, tips and advice and support each other, we are making each other's life so much better.
Well, Kim J, I'm very much looking forward to inviting you back onto the show when the fantasy novel is published. And who knows, maybe nominated for a Costa Award. But in the meantime, if people want to track down your two wonderful cookbooks, they're both available from Amazon. Your surname is J-A-Y-E. And what are the titles of the two cookbooks?
The Indian one is A Taste of Spice, and the other one is A Sense of Cooking.
And proceeds go to RNIB, for which very many thanks. And Kim J, thank you so much for being a guest on the show and sharing your love of reading with us.
No, thank you very much for having me.
And a reminder, Kim J's two books are available from Amazon, and her name is Kim, K-I-M, J, J-A-Y-E. And Kim will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Elizabeth Acevedo shares the backstory to her latest novel in verse, Clap When You Land. But first, a talking book would be nothing without a narrator, or sometimes two. One of the benefits of life before lockdown, when I was based at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden, was that I got to meet a lot of my favourite voices in the flesh. With life hopefully returning to something like normal soon, let's go back to Camden and seek out one of the most distinctive. Among the dozens of titles that David John has recorded during his career, he's carved out a niche in books set in London. When I caught up with him, he was recording the sequel to Tony Parsons' Man and Boy. So, before we hear about the challenges and joys of David's life as a narrator, here's a clip of him narrating Man and Wife.
He is the best of me, my son. And this special day would feel hollow if he wasn't there. In a few days' time, when the wedding cake has gone and the new married life has begun, and the world starts getting back to normal, some teacher will ask Pat what he did at the weekend. I went to my dad's wedding, he will say. And although he doesn't tell me any more than that, I can guess at the knowing laughter that unguarded, innocent remark endlessly replayed will cause in the staff room. How they will chuckle. How they will sigh. A sign of the times, my son's teachers will think. Children spending the weekend watching one of their parents get spliced. What a world, eh?
David John narrating Man and Wife, written by Tony Parsons. So, how are you enjoying Man and Wife?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I'm in second day so far, so we're still in the early stages. But of course, I've read through the book and prepared it. And so it's one of these books because it's character led and the main character is a North London kind of guy. It's a good one for me. I can empathise with the main character.
I was going to say, you've got the perfect voice for it.
Yeah, I think that's why they gave me a call.
And have you read Tony Parsons' other books in the past?
Yeah, the first one, yeah.
That's Man and Boy?
Yeah, that's right.
And you enjoyed them?
Yeah, I have enjoyed them, yeah. What's good about, as a reader, as in a narrator of a book, is that, you know, the main voice, the narrator voice, if it's easy to read, then it makes a big difference to us. If it comes off the page, if it's kind of written as kind of natural dialogue kind of style, that's really good for us. And that's what you find with Tony. He writes, you know, kind of very natural, authentic dialogue.
Yes, it's dialogue as it's spoken on the street, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yeah. So if you're just reading it, it's fine. But if you then start to try and narrate it and lift it off the page and read it as you go, it's almost sight reading with audiobooks. Although you've prepared it, you know, things come up very quickly. And if it's written in that style that Tony uses, it makes our job a lot easier.
Have you narrated many other talking books over the years?
Yeah, I have. I think I'm on around 60, maybe more than that. I mean, I've lost count now, but I've been doing it for probably about 10 years, audiobooks. So,
and do you have a favourite genre?
I've probably worked on more London crime than anything else, for obvious reasons. You know, all the London villainy, cops and robbers type thing. And if it's a really well-written book, if it's good, you know, for as a narrator, if it's a good book and it's well-written and it's character-led, then they're the ones you kind of enjoy the most.
And do you listen to audiobooks in your spare time, or are you a paperback man?
I still like to read myself. I do listen to audiobooks, but more out of professional interest, listening to other readers, and because it's one of these jobs that when you're doing it, it's one thing, but you've got to understand that as a listener, what you're listening for and what you need as a listener. So it's important for us, I think, to listen to other readers and think, oh, that works really well. That style really works. That's a bit too quick. You know, that characterisation is a bit too much. It doesn't really need, you know, so it's as a kind of out of professional interest, you would listen to other readers. But I don't sit and listen to whole books myself.
And it's an exciting time to be a narrator. And more books are being published simultaneously in audio and print, aren't they?
Yeah, it is. I mean, since I started, I think there's been a real kind of boom in audiobooks. We hear about it a lot. We hear about all the books that are now available. Of course, there weren't downloads then. When I started recording books, it was mainly cassettes, believe it or not, and a lot of stuff for library. But commercially, I think they're more popular than they've ever been before. And as you say, they want everything recorded. So that's, you know, more work, hopefully, for us, and more reading to do.
Keeps you out of trouble.
Yeah, keeps me off the street, yeah.
Indeed. From the audiobooks that you've listened to or that you've recorded yourself, do you have any particular favourites that stick in your mind?
That's a difficult one because actually I did a series of Spanish, because I speak Spanish, so I did a few books that had a lot of Spanish in them, and they were English translations of Arturo Pérez Reverte, he was called. The Captain a la Triste stories set in the kind of back streets of Seville in Spain and Andalusia back in the 1700s. And they were just, because it was different for me, because I usually get the modern London contemporary stuff, which I enjoy. But I found this really interesting because I love Spain myself and Spanish culture and all the rest of it. So those I found really interesting. They were quite hard for me to do because they weren't my usual kind of style. But I found it fascinating. And they were so well written. The books are great. I mean, they're great old swashbuckling kind of adventure stories in Spain. A lot of Spanish characters and accents and things like that. So I found those, they were a challenge. But, I, you know, they stick in my mind as things. I really enjoyed doing them.
Did he write The Club Duma as well?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great book, isn't
it? Yeah, there's Purity of Blood, and it's all about, you know, the Spanish Inquisition and all around that period. So, you know, I'm fascinated with all history, but, you know, Spanish cultural history in particular. So they're great. They're a great read.
The Corsairs, realising that flight was impossible and having no desire to surrender, were using the oars to position themselves to face into the wind. Galleys and galleots alike had but one large cannon at the prow and short-range pedreros, stone-throwers, along the sides. The crew of the galleot were not as well-armed as we were, and there were fewer of them. But if they were prepared to play their last card, one lucky shot could unmast us, or injure a good few of our men. And using their oars meant they could manoeuvre the vessel, despite the adverse wind. "Lower both masts! Shirts off! Row!" It was clear from the orders he gave, sharp as pistol shots, that Captain Ardamalas had also understood.
My guest, David John, narrating Pirates of the Levant by Arturo Perez Reverte, which is available commercially.
I'd love to ask you about how you prepare to make a talking book.
Yeah, this is key for us, actually. It's probably one of the most important parts of the process. When you get a book, the preparation is absolutely key. Some people have made the mistake of just reading the book and going in the studio, and it then takes much, much longer to record. If you're not prepared, if you don't know what's coming, if you haven't got all your character voices practiced and rehearsed, it just doesn't work. And the other thing is, if you've got the time, I mean, it does take a lot of time, you can read the book just to get a shape and a feel and a knowledge of the book and see what the author is going for. And then you go back and read the book again and you mark up everything. Because often, as you know, you're reading a book and it will say something in speech marks, blah, 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 says Johnny, who's got an Irish accent at the end of the sentence. So you have to know that that's Johnny in his Irish accent before you get to the explanation. So you often have a colour scheme where you mark up Johnny is yellow, you know, Brenda is green. And so you have colour codes for each character. So maybe your lines are, you underline each sentence, or you have a little tab at the beginning. And we can do this nowadays on iPads. You can mark up everything on an iPad, or you can do it on paper with your little, you know, just make yourself a key so you've got little warnings of what's coming up. And if you do that job well, the preparation, studio becomes a whole different experience because you can really enjoy it more. You know what's coming. It can get on top of you, an audiobook, because it comes up quickly. You know, things come up, things happen quickly. Suddenly you're there, oh, I didn't realise I was coming. So if you get the shape of it and you know it really well, familiarity is so important.
And actually, every so often I'll hear the narrators swapping tips and stories in the green room, which is quite fascinating.
Absolutely, yeah. And also, of course, in terms of your voice, you have to make sure your voice is properly warmed up, because you can lose, you know, so it can be a long day recording an audiobook. Not only in terms of the voice, which can get, you know, tired, but in terms of focus, concentration. If just you in the studio, if you're in there 4, 5, 6 hours sometimes,
wow,
you know, it can be it's a hard day's work. I'm not trying to get sympathy here. It's a great job. I love it. But, you know, there's more to it than I think most listeners would realise. It's one of those things, unless you've done it, you kind of don't quite understand what it takes.
Well, I think I speak for all the listeners when I say that the hard work is very much appreciated, because for many of us, the worst aspect of sight loss is actually losing the ability to read. So having somebody reading to us is just a lifeline.
Great. That's great to hear. That's what it's all about.
Thanks to David John. For a full list of the many titles that he's recorded for RNIB, visit the library website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline
on 0303 123 9999.
The helplines open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Kim Jay to hear the books of her life, last month the shortlist for this year's Silip Carnegie Medal was announced. The award is the world's oldest prize recognising outstanding children's literature, and the list of former winners includes many of the best-loved children's authors of all time. This year's shortlist includes two previous winners and reveals explorations of freedom, the great outdoors, and grief to be key recurring themes. The result will be announced on the 16th of June, and before that, Read On aims to bring you interviews with all eight shortlisted authors. This week, it's the turn of Elizabeth Acevedo. Last time we heard from Liz, it was just after she'd won the 2019 Silip Carnegie Medal for her novel in verse, The Poet X. And now she's been shortlisted for the same award for Clap When You Land. Here she is to tell us all about it and to fill us in on what she's been up to over the last 2 years. Liz, welcome back to Read On.
Hello, Red. It's so nice to be here.
And many, many congratulations on another nomination for the Silip Carnegie Medal.
I am so taken aback. I am very happy with the novel Clap When You Land, but I was not expecting this in any way, so I'm delighted.
It's a very moving story. For those who haven't yet picked it up, could you give us an introduction, please?
Yes. Clap When You Land is the story of two sisters, Camino, who lives in the Dominican Republic, and Yahaira, who lives in New York City, but they don't know about each other. Their father had a secret family, and they don't learn about each other until he dies in a plane crash. And so it's a novel of love and loss and whether or not two people can connect in the face of a lot of secrets.
And it's based on real events.
It is. In 2001, there was a flight that crashed on its way from New York City to the Dominican Republic, flight AA587. There were no survivors from the flight, and it really rocked the Dominican community, specifically in New York. And so I grew up. I was 12 years old at the time. We knew folks who had been on that flight. And so it was something that hit home, that always felt like there's something here that feels really important to commemorate. And I wasn't sure in what form. And the novel came from research, from learning about the people who had been on the plane and the lives they left behind.
It feels as if it must have been a very private grief, because it happened so soon after September the 11th that it was just lost in a welter of news.
Yes. I mean, it was 2 months after the attack on the World Trade Center in the exact same city. And I think initially the response was this idea that it might be a terrorist attack. And so there was a lot of attention on the flight, and it crashed into an actual community in Queens, New York. And so there were people on the ground who had been affected. It was just a huge event. But I think once it was determined that it wasn't terrorism, it was such a stark change in how the story was told and how quickly the people were forgotten. The individuals who were on that plane, the things they were getting ready to do, they were retiring, they were going back to open nonprofits. There was a soldier who had recently been deployed. This is 2001, so he was in the Middle East and had just come back after several years and wanted to visit his sister in the Dominican Republic. And so I felt like the humanity of these folks' story was lost in the fact that it wasn't this great fear we had thought it would be. But it was still this great loss.
And it's that grief that you're giving a voice to in the book, just as you gave the protagonist of The Poet X a voice in that book.
I'm really into looking at the stories that maybe feel familiar, but giving point of views from folks who maybe are a little bit stranger than we would imagine the heroines of a novel to be. We hear stories of great loss and of great tragedies. But there are moments that feel particularly unique. And for me, this story of what it means to be someone who travels back and forth between countries and to be people who travel back and forth between countries it felt like a particular kind of story of how people can be multiple versions of themselves, of how they can hold multiple lives, of what the longing for the life you don't know can be. And so I do think I'm voicing something here that maybe some folks haven't heard or read.
And it's that sense of being caught between worlds, not feeling altogether part of one community or the other, but being deeply embedded in each, that both your girls in this story feel.
Yes, and I love that you said deeply embedded, right? I think sometimes when folks have this feeling of I'm neither from here nor from there, it feels like an absence, but I think it's actually you have a foot in each place and you're occupying a third space, and that feels really critical. And for me, these two characters that imagine the other one is living a better life for whatever reason, I want to challenge this idea of better. And in some ways, for one of the sisters, that better is very material. Like, you know, you legitimately live in all relative terms a more comfortable life or less physical fear, right? And so there are challenges to my wanting to complicate better and to complicate the grass being greener. But I do think that it was really hard, right? It was really hard to figure out, like, how do I give each one of these girls a world that feels like their own, but also this feeling of when our people leave a place behind, there is a rupture that happens. And you may not ever get over that. Your family may not ever get over that. And that so many people experience that, right? And so at some point, it almost becomes the normalized reality of immigration. You live within a rupture of, I am no longer from there. I also am not sure if I belong here. And I think young people especially who are longing to belong, especially in the years of adolescence, feel that truly, like, I don't know where I'm to go. And so I wanted to get into that, but it is easy as a writer to want to do many things.
But you capture that brilliantly with the fact that the father for both these girls is away, and it has been his way of life for the past 16 years that he's spent 9 months away from his daughter in the Dominican Republic and 3 months away from his daughter in New York. And then when both of them realize that he is not coming back, then that bridge between those two places is broken. And only their imagination can take the place of their father. And they can't think of him as the father that they looked up to so much anymore, because there is this terrible secret that they didn't know. He had another life on the other side.
Right. I am fascinated by the secrets our parents tell us and don't tell us. And even in the Poet X, there was a lot of secrecy, the things you couldn't say outside of the house, the things Xiomara couldn't say to her parents. And in this novel, I kept coming back to the question, how do you learn to forgive someone whose harm you don't learn of until they're gone? And if they cannot ask for forgiveness, if they can't make amends, what is that journey, right? In the midst of grief, all the other things you also inherit. And it felt like an important question and not one that had an easy answer. And I was okay with it not being simple, with the fact that the characters are still on a journey of reconciliation when the novel ends. There's no easy band-aid for the wounds our parents might cause, but there is the necessity of figuring out how to be ourselves beyond what our parents may have or may not have done. And so in many ways, some of the themes I attempted, some would say, are very sophisticated for young people, but I've found from listening to readers that they find that question in particular one that is compelling. How do we forgive our parents if they may not ever ask for forgiveness?
I suppose that's common for every human being. We all grow away from our parents and we all discover things about our parents that are not necessarily to our taste as we grow up and grow away from them. But in Camino and Yahaira's case, they don't get the chance to question their father, and all the questions are in their own heads and very immediately brought to life in your writing. As you say, you don't offer the easy answers, the easy band-aid. We have to experience their grief through our reading.
Yeah, I was advised against starting the novel the same day as the crash and like establishing the world beforehand or keeping the father on the page a little bit longer. But I really enjoyed dropping readers into the moment of turmoil, the catalyst of change. I think it's my way of teaching a reader how to read my work. There's slowness and there are moments to luxuriate in the language and in the feelings of the characters, but I also don't like to coddle readers. And so for me, dropping them in early into a situation of, I need you to learn this world and I'm not going to overexplain it. I trust that you can do this work. I think says a lot between the relationship I'm trying to establish with my readers and what I expect of them. There's work here.
And because we see the community of grief that the two girls share, we also realize that these are universal feelings, which is our entrance into tackling these questions.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't thought of the ways that I may have mirrored how the two sisters were grieving and how their communities were coming across. I wanted to be really thoughtful and not privileging one of the places in terms of my depictions. Because I'm more familiar with New York, it would have been very easy to show that community in fuller detail than the Dominican Republic. And so I wanted to create a clear sense of place, a clear sense of where hyper-specifically these young women were coming from. And I think it's in being specific in how they were mourning in their grief practices and their communal practices that we start seeing the similarities of, oh, but look at how they are actually ritualizing the same kinds of things in order to get through this moment without realizing on separate parts of the world. And so, yeah, I'm glad you picked that up, Red, because I did not.
Well, I felt that was actually the seedbed for where the hope in the novel grows, because we've talked a lot about the grief and the pain, but actually the novel is also full of hope. And part of that is finding something to fill the hole that the girl's father has left, which they managed to find themselves.
Yes, I mean, hope is really important for me. And initially, when I began writing the novel, I wrote the entire thing from only one sister's perspective. It was entirely in Yahaira's perspective. I didn't think I would have the other sibling. And I was talking with a writer named Ibi Zaboy, who wrote the novel American Street and Pride, which is a retelling of Pride and Prejudice. And I'm telling her about the story, and I'm like, you know, I have this book. I'm really interested in the questions it's asking, but there's something missing. And I'm telling her what's at play. And she goes, oh, we need the other sibling. We need the voice of the girl who often isn't heard. And that was a game changer for me in terms of figuring out how to address hope, that pitting these two girls' desires and what they imagined could be a fulfilling life if they were able to get over this moment or see what this moment had to show them, like that they could see that other side. They both have very clear intent on where they want to go next. And once I brought in Camino's voice, I mean, it changed the novel for me and it changed what I could have them hope for. And so it was interesting. You know, you bring in another perspective and it opens up how much light a book is able to have, even as that perspective was an incredibly difficult one. I mean, difficult isn't the right word, but Camino's situation as I was writing it developed as more and more dire. And yet it was through writing her character that I could achieve this idea of look at what happens if we are able to relate to each other in a way that comes from empathy and holding space for our individual experiences and griefs, but not at the expense of someone else who's also feeling that. The novel taught me how to write it through what it required as I felt there's something missing and then realized, oh, this whole other side is missing for me to get to a satisfying ending.
And that decision has, of course, led to you bringing in a second narrator. You narrate Yahaira's story from the New York end. And, well, tell me about the second narrator and how she was brought in.
Yes, I was lucky enough that we were able to get Melania Luisa Marte to be the second narrator. My audiobook director read the novel, and as we were working on my second book with The Fire on High, she already had the manuscript for the third book. And so she's telling me she has ideas and she wants it to be multi-voice because it might be a little bit less confusing for a reader that's listening to have the two sisters depicted by different voices. And we collaborated. I sent her a list of spoken word artists and poets that I admired who were Dominican, who may have a sense of the world I'm writing from a personal level, but who were voice performers. And we landed on Melania Luisa and her ability to just really hold a moment and hold a space. And her style is close enough to mine that I think you get that idea of they are relational, but she's also a very different kind of poet in her cadences and how she brings energy to words. And so listening to her was such an art in learning how my words could sound in someone else's mouth. I've been lucky enough that I've been doing my own narration, so this was the first project where I could hear someone else deliver my language, but she was a dream to work with. And, you know, we won an audio award here in the States, which is one of the highest awards for audiobooks. So I think our decision was well received to work with Melania Luisa.
You actually have been rather successful with your audiobook narration throughout. I believe you won another audio award for your second book, The Fire on High.
Yes, I was nominated for the Poet X. I've always been nominated in two categories, read by the author and also young adult. And with The Fire on High, won read by the author, beating Michelle Obama, which is my one claim, real claim to audiobook fame that I outshined becoming. But also this latest book won two awards. It won the young adult category and it won the multi-voice category. And so it's an unexpected kind of brilliant moment in my career that my performance background and my years of doing poems on stages as a living has now translated to doing poems in studios that are also equally as powerful, I think, or being received in that way. And so shout out to all those pubs and colleges that I recited at that got my chops together. It's exciting.
I am beginning to learn that life-altering news is often like a premature birth, ill-timed, catching someone unaware, emotionally unprepared, and often where they shouldn't be. I am missing a math test. Even though Bobby will get in a taxi upon arriving, I skipped my last two periods so I could wait at the airport. I'll make up the exam tomorrow, I convinced myself. Bobby's homecoming, for me, is a national holiday, and I don't rightly care that he's going to be livid. He reminds me once a week he pays too much money for my fancy schooling, for me to miss or fail classes. But he shouldn't fuss since I'm always on honor roll. I also know Bobby will be secretly elated. He loves to be loved. And his favorite girl, waiting at the airport with a sign and a smile, what better homecoming?
Elizabeth Acevedo, narrating Clap When You Land, which is available from the RNIB Library. And could you explain the title?
Yes, if folks have traveled to either Latin America, the Caribbean, certain parts of the continent of Africa or of Asia, you'll notice that when the plane lands, sometimes people will uproariously applaud. And my first time going to the Dominican Republic, when I had memory, I was 8 years old, and the plane lands, everyone starts clapping. I look around, I don't know what's happening. I start clapping because it feels like, okay, something celebratory has happened, but also that it needed no explanation, that it was, oh, we are all communally joyous that the pilot did his job, that the sky did its job, that everything worked out the way it should be, and also that we've come back, that we've returned. And that bittersweetness of that moment of landing, I've seen folks joke like, oh, I hate it when people clap. And it brought to light to me, oh, they don't understand what this means. It is a particular experience. And the title is one of the first things that people clearly note about the novel. And the thing I probably get the most comment on, honestly, I've been tagged in so many pictures of folks commenting on their experiences of first doing this ceremony, I guess. And so it's this interesting little factoid that I just thought was really cool. I loved clapping when I land. It makes me feel joyous when I arrive somewhere. And I'm now hearing from people all over the world who are in defense of applauding when you land. And my title, I think, makes a clear nod to that celebration.
Now, I know you have one sadness about the publication of this book, because it was during lockdown. It meant that you didn't get to go out and mix with the audience, especially within the New York Dominican community.
I was really looking to touring. It was one of the highlights that I had. One of my favorite things is imagining meeting the readers. It's such a lonely experience to write a whole book. You have all of these anxieties and insecurities. Did I put enough of what's in my head on the page? Will they see why I was compelled to work on this for years without coming up for air? Will they understand the tenderness and generosity that I'm trying to approach these characters and these communities with? And for me, those first events where you get on a stage and there are 200, 300 people listening to you read and they're nodding and they come up after and they share their experiences and what they know, it is a solidifying act almost. Like, okay, yes, the book has been christened in fire and now it is in the world. It feels like my handoff. I wrote it and now I give it away and I know it's in the world. And so to do that virtually was not the same ceremonial experience for me. It kind of felt like, is the book in the world? Are people reading it? Are there humans on the other side of this? But, you know, I also was gratified in the fact that I had people globally tuning into my events, that I had more Dominicans from the Dominican Republic coming to my events than ever before because they could join me virtually. Melania Luisa Marte, who I did my launch event with, was in the Dominican Republic when she did that event with me and we could talk about the book. And so there were also moments that I realize now virtual and this interconnected world of the online experience did get me to connect with certain readers. But because the book is rooted in this historical moment of Flight AA-587, it has felt different to receive messages and comments online about folks who have had family members who were on that flight and feel maybe like, oh, I would have loved to have heard this in person, or I would have loved to have been able to connect and hear your loved one's name and not have it be a public spectacle in a chat section. Like, I would have loved to have this moment and looked at you and say, like, I see you and I hear you and I hope this book does something for the memory of your loved one. I don't know. I think that's the one thing that this book offered that other books didn't, that it is rooted in that. And so, yeah, I guess I grieve that a little bit, but that's also like a selfish thing for me to want. So I'm okay as long as the book does something for anyone who is descended from someone on that flight, that's enough.
Well, Elizabeth Acevedo, thank you so much for sharing their story and the story of Clap When You Land with the Read On listeners.
Thanks so much, Red. It's such a pleasure to talk with you always.
Both Clap When You Land and The Poet X are available in audio and braille from the RNIB library. Now it's back to Kim J for the books of her life.
Kim, was there a book that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
When I was a child, we came from Kenya when I was three. And by the age of three, I was always already reading. My mother said, you know, I was born with a book in front of my face. And we didn't have much money. And at the time, there was this great offer on a particular chocolate where if you collected the wrappers, sent them off, you got a Ladybird book. And my mother, that's what she did because she knew I loved reading, didn't have much money. So she started collecting these chocolate wrappers. So it wasn't a particular book that set me on the path for reading and writing. It was a series of books. It was the amazing Ladybird fairy stories. One in particular really caught my attention, which was Cinderella. I loved Cinderella. I loved the pictures. I can still remember the gowns that she wore, pink, blue, white, yellow. And for me, it wasn't just about reading the book. When I got to the last page, even at the age of three or four, my memory and my imagination went riot. I carried on the story. So in my head, the ugly sisters were thrown out of the kingdom, went into a forest and had all these adventures. And that was a great thing about the books as a child, that you could let your imagination go riot and do things and go places where you have never been before.
Cinderella is one of many classic stories contained in Ladybird Tales, the complete audio collection narrated by Wayne Forrester, which is available via Audible.
Once upon a time, there was a little girl called Cinderella. Her mother was dead, and she lived with her father and two stepsisters. Cinderella's stepsisters were fair of face, but because they were bad-tempered and unkind, their faces grew to look ugly. They were jealous of Cinderella because she was a lovely child, and so they were often unkind to her. The stepsisters made Cinderella do all the work in the house. She worked from morning till night without stopping. Cinderella not only did all the housework, but she also helped her stepsisters to dress. She cleaned their shoes, brushed their hair, tied their ribbons, and fastened their buckles.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Oh, definitely. It's a lovely series of books. The first one is called Daughter of the Forest by Juliet Mariella. That's Mariller. And this series is amazing. For me, it's like a comfort blanket. The first book in the trilogy is a fairy story. We all know the story of the 12 brothers that were turned into swans by the wicked stepmother. So it's based on that. So we have six brothers, and the wicked stepmother turns them into a swan, and the sister, Soka, has to knit them all shirts made from stalwart, which is a thistle plant in Ireland. Now, the book is set in Ireland, and the narrator is Irish, and she has this amazing Gaelic voice that just draws you in. And this story starts with Soka trying to make these shirts and go on this adventure, and it is absolutely heartwarming. You sit there and you start reading this book and you think, I'm an adult, I'm reading a fairy story, but it's a fairy story for adults. And it just makes you feel good, and it takes you back to when you were a child. By the end of the book, you put it down, and the first thing that I did, I ordered the next book in the series, and then the book after that, and the series after that. Each one of these books is amazing.
Three children lay on the rocks at the water's edge. A dark-haired little girl, two boys slightly older. This image is caught forever in my memory, like some fragile creature preserved in amber. Myself, my brothers. I remember the way the water rippled as I trailed my fingers across the shining surface.
Don't lean over so far, Soka, said Podrick. You might fall in.
He was a year older than me and made the most of what little authority that gave him. You could understand it, I suppose. After all, there were six brothers altogether, and five of them were older than he was. I ignored him, reaching down into the mysterious depths.
She might fall in, mightn't she, Finbar?
A long silence. As it stretched out, we both looked at Finbar, who lay on his back, full length on the warm rock.
Lara Hutchinson, narrating Daughter of the Forest by Juliet Mariella, which, like all the books in her Seven Waters series, is available from the RNIB library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
There is, and it's a classic book. I love my classic books. And it's A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irvine. It is a little bit of a difficult book to get into, but it is well worth reading. For me, John Irvine is a modern American version of Thomas Hardy. So a lot of his books is about social history and the environment at the time that he's writing in. So A Prayer for Owen Meany is set in the 1950s and 1960s, and it follows the story of two boys, John and Owen Meany. Now, Owen Meany is a small boy eccentric, very remarkable, and extremely strange. You start reading it and you think, oh, there's no storyline to this. It's a book about two children growing up in New Hampshire in the 50s. But you're sort of drawn into their lives and you follow what they're doing and you get involved. And it is really interesting. And you get so drawn in that you miss something very, very important. And then I got to the chapter, the climax of the book. I'm not going to tell you what happened. And I read this chapter and I stopped at the end of it. And all of a sudden, sparks started flying in my brain. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've missed everything. I now understand what he was going on about. And for the first time in my life, I went back to the beginning of the chapter and reread it again. And it was one of those light bulb moments where everything just sort of clicks into place and you think, now I understand. Finished the book, and then again, for the first time in my life and the only time, I went straight back to the beginning of the book and reread it. And this time, knowing how the story ends, I actually was reading the story behind the story, if that makes sense, and it just totally blew me away. It is hard going, but it is well worth having a read of this. It is a really good book.
I am doomed to remember a boy with a wrecked voice. Not because of his voice, or because he was the smallest person I ever knew, or even because he was the instrument of my mother's death, but because he is the reason I believe in God. I am a Christian because of Owen Meany. I make no claims to have a life in Christ or with Christ, and certainly not for Christ, which I've heard some zealots claim. I'm not very sophisticated in my knowledge of the Old Testament, and I've not read the New Testament since my Sunday school days, except for those passages that I hear read aloud to me when I go to church. I'm somewhat more familiar with the passages from the Bible that appear in the Book of Common Prayer. I read my prayer book often, and my Bible only on holy days. The prayer book is so much more orderly.
Garrick Hagen, narrating A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving, which is available from the RNIB Library. Kim J, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the listeners and for being a guest on the show.
No, thank you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your preferred provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.